from the Gothic Quarter in Barcelona. This is Market Movers, the podcast that gives you a closer look at the financial markets to trade responsibly. Here are your hosts, Lior Cohen and Yochai Elam.
Hello, welcome, and season greetings. I'm your co-host, Lior Cohen, and joining me, he's the Crunchmaster of Forex Crunch, Yochai Elam. How's it going, Yochai? Oh, wait. I forgot he's already started his vacation. Obviously, I cannot do the show without him, so this week we'll repeat three past segments, including risk-reward ratio, golden inflation, Japan, past and present. We'll return next week and kick off the new year with new episodes of Market Movers. So Yochai and I would like to thank you again for listening, subscribing, spreading the good word, and just have a great year and enjoy the holidays. And let's kick it off with the risk-reward ratio, Yochai.
Yeah, well, what is the risk-reward ratio and why is it important for you? The risk-reward ratio in Forex is basically the number of pips that you risk, that's the risk, if the price reaches the stop-loss point, versus the number of pips that you'll gain if the price hits your take-profit point. And why is that important? Because when you have a system, you want the system to be profitable. You want to have a positive risk-reward ratio. That means that on a winning trade, you're going to win more pips than on a losing trade. So optimally, the reward side should be 3 times the size of the risk. Also, 2-to-1 is okay. A better ratio means that, in theory, you need less winning trades to be a profitable trader, because this is assuming that you don't take profit before it hits the take profit point, and hopefully you aren't moving your stops, which of course is very dangerous, and we all hope you're not doing that. So by taking a good risk-reward ratio and sticking to it, not only talking about it in practice, you may actually have more losing trades than winning ones, but the magnitude of the wins will compensate for the number of losses.
Yeah, I understand that, and I remember that also from Nassim Taleb's one of his books. He have like 3 books, and all of them talk more or less about the same thing. And this is also one of the points he made out of the clutter of all the words that he had in that book, because it was, you know, pretty prolonged and maybe just, you know, just a few diamonds you can scoop out of that entire series of 3 or 4 books that he has. And one of them is about if they had 2 options, one, just, you know, lose a little bit every day and then have a great payday in the stock market, or make a very small gains and then reach a point where they lose a lot, then even though most people will say, oh, in advance, yeah, of course, I'll take the former than the latter. But in reality, most people, what they do is take the latter, in which they just make a little bit of gains along the way, and then suddenly they have an exposure and boom, they have a sudden sharp collapse. This is also, I think, is also something that relates to what you're trying to say.
Yeah. So, of course, if you already have a system that incorporates risk-reward ratio, that's perfectly great. But even if you have this thing, the problem begins with when you begin having an itch for a trade. That means you're emotionally a bit more excited and you see something. Of course, this happens to many traders and happens too many times. So basically, use your system to find a potential trade. And now that you're aware of the risk-reward ratio, you take that simple calculation and try to implement it. And you see that you don't get the risk-reward ratio we were talking about, either 2-to-1 or 3-to-1 or even better. So what do? One wrong thing to do is to squeeze your stop loss. Of course, this will improve your ratio, but if the pair doesn't go in your direction soon enough, it will hit your stop loss soon enough, and then you're insured for a loss. First of all, you're losing money, and in addition, this frustration could lead to neglecting the risk-reward ratio afterwards. Another wrong thing to do is to widen the take profit. Also, this will improve your risk-reward ratio, but it also means that you have a lower chance of hitting that take profit. That means that if your system was good before incorporating this risk-reward ratio, the price has low chances of hitting the take profit now.
So in reality, if you take profits out, then you actually change the risk-reward ratio, and thus it could also change your decision-making and consequentially?
Yeah, you could actually have a trade that goes in your direction, but your take profit point is just too far off because of just trying to impose the risk-reward ratio on your system. Widening your take profit is wrong because if you had a good system, it might not work well, because even if the trade goes in your direction, it could not hit the take profit point and eventually turn back against you and hit the stop loss point. So you lose money once again just by trying to impose this wider stop, this wider take profit point, and trying to impose the risk reward ratio. So what is the third option? What's the right thing to do? Well, the right thing to do is not to do anything in this case, just walk away.
Well, that's very convenient.
Yeah, also taking a decision not to trade is a good decision, a legitimate one. The market will be there also tomorrow, also tonight, also tomorrow morning. So
I think that's trying to fight human nature in a way, because we always want to do something as opposed to just sit and wait in certain situations, where in fact, in certain situations, just to sit and wait could also be the best option available for that specific turn of events.
Right, but in order to perfect your trading, you need to sometimes work against human nature and be a bit more disciplined.
Oh, that's hard. Yeah, that's hard for me. Yeah, I'm trying to still look at this Danish and trying to struggle not to eat it. And, you know, that's human nature, just to eat the Danish, man. So
yeah, put it.
I don't know, how is that
don't touch,
when it comes
touch,
to a yeah. lot of dollars? Yeah, when it comes to dollars, I think it's even harder, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
This is Danish for a dollar, yeah.
Dollars also have a good smell, well, in your mind at least. Anyway, so the right thing to do is really to walk away. Okay, your system had a nice setup, but the risk-reward ratio that you suffered for that specific trade was poor, so just walk away. The trade just isn't good enough. Other trades that fit your system and provide a good risk-reward ratio will just come along. Be patient.
Let's turn to gold and inflation.
They found gold at Sutter's Mill.
When you talk about gold, obviously most people think about, okay, it's another safe haven investments against the inflation. Does it really come up to be a safe haven in your point of view?
Well, it doesn't have any yield, so if there is inflation, you don't get anything back in return. Just rely on the price of gold to continue rising. And if there is inflation and too much money printed all over the world, people expect the price of gold to go up. Well, but that isn't always the case, is it?
Yeah, that's the thing. I know that a lot of people bought gold, or at least that's my guess, at least, that especially after the economic crisis of 2008, suddenly we saw a sudden sharp rise in gold prices and reaching almost to the 1900s, and and people even suspected that gold prices couldn't go all the way to $2,000 per ounce.
Yeah, it wasn't that far away, but it stopped there.
Yes, that's true. It stopped there and it collapsed in 2000, the beginning of 2003, all the way down to around 1400, 1300. And ever since then, it's been around 1300. It hasn't done much ever since. The questions we will try to answer is, first, does gold protect you from inflation? Is it a safe haven? And what could we expect from the rise? How can we explain the rise and fall of gold prices in the past couple of years or so? And of course, what is next for gold? So when we talk about protection from inflation, I think for one thing, people talk about that when they talk about inflation, they talk about first and foremost the state of the economy and how the Fed implements its monetary policy. For that, as you well know, Yochai, the Fed has done implemented a lot of steps in order to jumpstart the economy. If we'll see in the coming months that the Fed will start to pull back, as it does now with tapering QE3 and maybe raising the rates, and we'll talk about that later in the show about the FOMC's next meeting. The logical conclusion is that thus the fear of inflation will dissipate a little bit and gold prices will fall back down. So for one thing, I think that the old notion of gold being a hedge against inflation, I think it started off roughly in the 70s with the oil crisis and the embargo of the Arab nations in OPEC. And back then, if you hold on to your hat, oil prices soared from $3 per barrel to $12 by March of 74. Yes, $12. Ludicrous, right? So with that coincided also the rally of other commodities. There was copper, there was gold, thus considered more of a safe haven, especially after the additional crisis of 79 with Iran, which led to a sharp rise in inflation numbers. Back then, the inflation rose to, in 1980, it was in 13.5%.
The United States.
Yes, in the United States, 1980, and 1979 was 11%. And with that coincided the rise of gold. Back then, it rose from, in 77, it was around $148 per ounce. And in 1980, it reached $673 back in September of 1980.
Wow.
Even though it's still less than half than what it is now, it's still a sharp rise. In 1 year, in 79, from 79 to 78, the average annual price rose from $306 to $612. So that's double the money in 1 year because, for one thing, people saw there's a rise in inflation, so everybody jumped into gold and voila, we have a sharp rise in gold price.
Yeah, much more than the rise of inflation at the time.
Yes, so that's another point, and I'll get to it right in a minute, but that's another point about, is it a hedge? So you can understand that it's not a hedge. Just finishing this thought that the rise was so staggering, and following the Fed's monetary steps of raising the long-term interest rates, yes, they raised them, the short-term interest rates, excuse me, which obviously exceeded to long-term interest rates, raised it up to the level of 19 to 20% back in May 1980. We saw a sudden collapse of the gold prices. They fell all the way down to, in 95, it went all the way down to $317. So you can understand that when we talk about a hedge, what do you want from a hedge? You want, one, to protect, to correspond with the risk involved. So in this case, we want the risk of the money devaluing, and also to be equally volatile. And in this case, gold is number one. It's very volatile, as you can see it back from the 80s, and also now in the recent years, until 2013 at least, you saw it was very volatile. And for one thing, it's not corresponding with the rise in inflation. If inflation goes up by 10% in a year, you want an asset to cover you by 10%. If it goes by 20%, okay, you made money, but it's not a hedge anymore. It's not a safe haven. It's just...
Yeah, it's just buying like any other stock or any other financial speculation.
Exactly. I mean, for all intents and purposes, if you want that kind of a hedge, then buy a company that follows inflation. For instance, you can buy the big retailers, if it's Walmart or other similar companies that, you know, their prices go up and thus also their revenue and thus also their asset, the stock price, and they correspond and much more similarly to the rise in inflation. Or of course, American US treasury bonds, that's also something that follows inflation. How do you think about gold as a safe haven, though? Yochai, what's your input on that?
Well, in ancient times, and I think also now in areas of conflict, if you have physical gold, it's a safe haven because it'll always be worth something. So if you need to flee, it's also relatively easy to take gold, diamonds, other precious metals. But so it's a great hedge if you don't believe in the system at all. I guess physical gold, but if you don't believe in the system, why would you buy ETFs or mining stocks or anything gold related and not the actual physical thing?
Yes, that's an interesting point. And if you don't believe in the system, then who would say that you will can fall back on the CME and their system as well, because that's also part of the system. So there's that, and of course, if you go to Rick Perry, he still believes that Bernanke is literally an enemy of the state with what he has done in recent years with the QE program. So there are people who do believe that we'll have just a rising inflation right around the corner. So there's that. Do you think if we see about the rise of gold prices in the past few years from 2007 till 2013 or so, do you think it was driven by a fear of inflation or just because we had a crisis, or any other factor they think corresponded to this turn of events?
So basically, after the global financial crisis, the United States, the United Kingdom, Japan, and perhaps other central banks began printing money, basically wanting to lower long-term interest rates and help the economy. And this money also spilled to other places such as stocks and commodities. And it, of course, contributed to the rise in the price of gold. But I think that most of the rise in the price of gold has been speculation from gold bugs who grabbed media attention, and the rising prices, which accelerated more money, pushed more money into gold. So it looks like more of a speculation. And at some point, when the money stopped pouring in, when the music stopped, basically the price of gold began falling. The taper tantrum was one of these points, but not the only one. I see it less as a hedge against inflation, which never came, and more of a speculation that went one way and then went the other way. Some other traders went short and made a lot of money on the fall as well.
Yes, so you more of the idea that it's a speculation over a fear of a sudden rise in inflation then?
Yeah, all the people talking about hyperinflation, the Weimar Republic, Zimbabwe, I think they went really, really, really too far, because inflation never appeared, and households in the United States and Europe and other places were deleveraging all the debt they had. So despite all this money floating around, nobody wanted to take on more debt. So even though the banks have so much money, they don't have who to lend it to, and the banks themselves are they're getting better, but they weren't in such a good state, let's call it that way, after the global financial crisis. So basically, all this money creating never triggered inflation. It still might trigger higher inflation than countries want, maybe 5-6% if things get out of control. But for a hyperinflation environment, for a hyperinflation event, we need a big political event and not only printing of money by the central bank.
Yes, so I also think that it's more about speculation and speculation over a sudden eruption of inflation, even though, as you said, we saw the Fed pumping cash into the system. And if you look at the money base, it did rise very substantially in the past few years, but when you look at M1, M2, or the inflation rates, as usual, you see that it's still very low, and between the 2 to 3% at the most in the past few years. So you didn't see a sudden rise in inflation, even though the Fed has been printing more money and trying to expand and jumpstart the economy. There is another interesting theory. I don't subscribe to it by fully, but I still think it's worth examining by economist Paul Krugman. And he tried to use a basic hoteling model for commodities, which is originally model for oil, natural gas, but he used it, you know, he kind of jammed it into a gold and tried to explain the rise, and to a certain extent you can also explain the sudden drop in gold prices. The idea is that gold tends to disappear over time until they reach one day the so-called choke price at which a flow of demand goes to zero, because there's no more gold left, so it disappears into the teeth, your additional electronics. So now we have to ask, okay, so what's the trajectory of? So it's based on the flow of demand. As demand rises, we see also a rise in the price, and steady and slow rise. The drop in real interest rates back in 2010 and 11 drove higher the demand over a short period of time, and that's what we saw also, a sudden sharp rise in gold prices due to the low interest rates of bullion enthusiasts that didn't need a price appreciation to hoard gold. So it's basically, in other words, the alternative price of holding gold dropped, so people stocked up on the yellow metal and delayed the consumption of gold for the future. This theory needs to consider gold as a consumed commodity, such as oil, natural gas. So if without that, it doesn't reach the choke price, and thus it falls apart. But it could partly explain the sharp rise in gold prices and gold hold, which is due to rise in gold holdings over a short period of time, and then remaining steady. And it also explains that back in 2013. To a certain extent, we saw a sudden jump in long-term interest rates, which more or less corresponded with the sudden drop in gold prices, because we saw a sudden rise in gold in long-term interest rates, prices, and thus contracted back to the 1300s. And since then, remained pretty stable. And on the other hand, the long-term interest rates also started to contract again very steadily. In a way, it does explain it, but not fully. But it's a nice, I think it's a nice little theory to consider. Looking forward, what is up ahead? So for one thing, we saw that by the end of August, the CME lowered its benchmark for margin for gold contracts
because of the drop in volatility. No.
Yes. Exactly. Because what they do is pretty simple. Back in 2013, for instance, or in 2010, when there was a sudden sharp rises in volatility, the CME just pulled right in and raised the margins, and suddenly we saw a sudden drop in gold prices. It was very imminent also for silver, dropped from the high 30s all the way down to the low 20s. It does have a very sharp effect. It doesn't have effect, on the other hand, when it's the other way around, because, so people can buy more and need less margins, but it doesn't mean that everybody will just jump in. They do jump out when they have a margin call and they need to when they have a higher margin, so they have to cover their bets. We only see usually this reaction from the other way around. But it may have had also a little bit of a positive impact on gold prices, because it remained pretty stable in August, in the few and in recent weeks. So we have that to consider, and we also have what's up ahead for the Fed. And we'll get into the next FOMC meeting pretty soon, but I'll just mention that in any case, if you take into consideration Krugman's theory or our theory, that it's mostly about the fear and inflation that never came into fruition. In either case, we see that the Fed plays a significant role in the direction of gold. And if the Fed will continue to be more hawkish and taper down its QE programs, which we know it does, and also raise interest rates next year, then it doesn't vote well for gold, and we could see a further contraction in gold prices. And where could it go? I don't know. I don't think it will remain at 1300s next year. I think it will go even lower than that, but we'll have to see what's up ahead for that. Yes, we're going to talk about Japan, big in Japan, and how Japan is doing. So in particular, we're going to talk about Japan as an economy, Bank of Japan's monetary policy, and what is up ahead. So Yohai, when we talk about Japan, what do you think about besides, obviously, the culture, the food, the people, when we talk about its economy in particular? Do you think they're in a good place, or they have some more room to develop?
Well, from an investor's point of view, they're still in a sketchy place, because growth is relatively unstable, the stock market is unstable, and the future is quite unknown. They did much better at the time that song was a big hit. When it was big in Japan, they were big, and technology, it was taking over the world. There was fear in the United States that Japan would buy everything, but things have changed since then. So
we're not where Japan is, not where it used to be in the booming 80s for them, that's for sure. And the Japan economy actually took a turn back in the 90s, which is also known as the lost decade, which has since expanded to the last couple of decades, because in the 2000 to 2010, we also didn't see much of a progress or improvement in when you talk about GDP wise or inflation or any particular indicators. Wages, they also became pretty stagnant. And specifically, if we look about the last few decades, from 95 to 2007, we see that GDP fell from roughly $5.3 trillion to $4.3 trillion in nominal terms. And real wages also declined. And the inflation remains flat. So what there is to do? They had a pretty big problem up their sleeves. And I think that the main difference was obviously, and Yohai, correct me if I'm wrong, was when the recent elections were concluded with Shinzo Abe became the prime minister again, the 57th prime minister of Japan, and thus open up the floodgates for a shift in its monetary policy, in its economic policy of the government and also Bank of Japan's. But do you think that his election really did much of a difference over it's very hard to pinpoint him for something that we're only looking about for what, a year and a half, so it's not, there's, we don't have much meat on the bone yet, but do you think he did well up until now?
Well, it's what he's trying to do, Shinzo Abe, is a huge reform, is changing the state of mind of Japanese corporations and Japanese people, and that's an uphill task. So he did have success, he did have some failures. He introduced three arrows of reforms. One was fiscal stimulus, which he introduced immediately, especially to encounter the huge damages of the March 2011 earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear disaster. And the second arrow is monetary policy. He appointed Kuroda as the governor of the Bank of Japan, and immediately Kuroda in April 2013 introduced a huge monetary blitz, basically a quantitative easing program of a much larger scale. Japan did that in the past in small scales without success.
Yeah, we're talking about something about, if correct me if I'm wrong, it's roughly $1.4 trillion over the 2 years. That's his asset purchase program, right? From that he delivered in April 2013, which is significantly higher than what they had in the previous years.
It's significantly higher than previous years, and we're talking about 10, 15 years of failed QE programs, failed interventions. And also, in comparison to the size of the economy, it's huge. Japan is the number three economy in the world after the US and China, and it's a huge QE program, so it's a big change. However, in the third arrow of structural reforms, Abe is still not delivering on his promises. He has more struggles there with pressure groups, in the industry, unions, from all sides of the spectrum. He doesn't have too much success, and some investors are beginning to lose patience.
What he's trying to do when it comes to reform, he's trying to increase wages and reduce unemployment. Are there things, I assume it's mostly things related to the labor market, right?
Yeah, so in Japan, as we know, once you enter a factory, usually you stay there for the rest of your life. There's not much dynamicism in the Japanese job market, so that's one point. On the other hand, they have an unemployment rate of under 4%. Which is, let's call it quite good, even excellent. That's big in Japan, yeah.
Obviously, when you look about it compared to what happened in Europe, where they have 11%, 11, 12%, and in the US now it's a little bit lower, it's around 6%, so it's getting a little bit closer to Japan. But back in the economic meltdown in 2007-08, was shot up to over 10%. Even though they have a low unemployment, the wages remain pretty stagnant, right? That's
exactly
one thing that they have a problem with. And they're not much of a nation of consumers. Pretty high savings rate. That's also something that keeps the economy from jumpstarting again.
Yeah. Well, we can look at it in a positive manner. It's better than the United States or other countries where the citizens are in huge debt, especially mortgages, and the economy is struggling. But there is a middle ground between extreme savings and extreme debt, and Japan can move to more consumption. That would really jumpstart the economy. Shinzo Abe did call on companies to raise wages. Of course, that would lift inflation, lift consumption, jumpstart the economy. So far, he had limited success with that. But as aforementioned, what he's trying to do in Japan is make a shift in the mindset of the people, of the companies, after 20 years of stagnation, and that's a hard task.
Yeah, and if you talked about debt, keep in mind that even though the economy is still stagnant and their rate of savings is pretty high, it's also something that their national debt still continues to be very high at 214-215% of GDP.
More than Greece.
Yes, so if you look only at this raw figure, you say, oh my god, Japan is on the verge of a collapse. But no, because most of this debt is internal. Only 60% of its debt comes from outside of Japan. So as long as most of this debt is internal, the Japanese people continue to have a high rate of savings. Then they still keep their national balance, and they don't have to look for any other sources of income. But it is a problem, and you also mentioned it a little bit that Shinzo Abe is trying also to reduce the national debt. This is where come in the recent tax hike, right?
Yeah, so 2013 was a good year for Shinzo Abe. He appointed Kuroda. Kuroda introduced the monetary blitz. There was fiscal stimulus. He was seen as a hero in Japan, very popular, and also in other places of the world. People came to Japan to study Abenomics, as it was called. But then he faced this debt issue, which, as you mentioned, is huge, and he decided to raise the tax rate, the sales tax, from 5 to 8% in April this year. This was already done back in the 90s, and it caused some economic shocks, but given the strong growth and his success, he went through with this. So what happened is at the beginning of 2014, the first quarter, we had consumers buy a lot of stuff and the economy booming just before the tax hike. And now we face the figures for the second quarter and we already expect a much worse picture.
Oh, so this brings us right to what we're looking up ahead in this today's big news item for Japan is the GDP for the second quarter. This is will be the preliminary estimate. And you say it's going to be significantly lower and will be devastating compared to what happened in the first quarter.
Yeah, so in the first quarter, we've seen a growth rate of 1.6% quarter over quarter. And now we're expecting a contraction of 1.7%. For our American listeners, in annualized terms, it means a contraction of no less than 7%. Okay.
Wow. So if we badmouth a little bit the US GDP for the first quarter, which was pretty bad and gruesome, then compared to what's going to happen in Japan, what happened in Japan the second quarter, it's a cakewalk.
Right, but
or a rice cakewalk or something. I don't know. Yeah. We have to, we have to adjust our terminology. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe some Japanese sake would sort of hangover from that. What the tax hike did do is raise the level of inflation to around 3%, and that's the target of the Bank of Japan. However, if you deduct the impact of the tax hike and look only at core inflation, we still have an inflation rate of only around 1%. So the path of the Bank of Japan to reach its inflation goal.
Yeah, so what it means that even though the Bank of Japan and the government under Abe is trying a lot of things to jumpstart the economy, as we said, they're trying to stimulate with the asset purchase programs. They have they continue to have the low cash rate. They're printing money. They're doing reforms. They're trying to do a little bit of reforms, but we still see that inflation remains flat, 1%, no budge, nothing. Maybe it budged a little bit compared to what we had a couple of years ago, but still, come on, 0%, 1%. That's like tomato, potato, no? Or something like that, or tomato, whatever. Yeah. Wherever you feel more comfortable with that.
Exactly.
With that phrasing.
Deflation in Japan is chronic. That means it's not just a temporary slide in prices, which means that consumers pay less for what they buy. It means that there is a mentality of deflation. It means that consumers don't buy in anticipation that prices will fall. And this is hard to change. We have seen the yen falling since Abe came to power. It fell big time during 2013.
Yeah, 17%. It fell since 2013 and up to now, 17%. It was around 86 to yen to $1, and now it's around 102.
Yeah, and during 2012, it was under 80 for quite a long time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so we saw a significant devaluation of the yen, even though, for instance, against the US dollar, even though, for all intents and purposes, we saw that the Fed also did similar actions when it came to keeping the interest rate low around zero and asset purchase programs also during 2013. So we saw similar type of actions, and yet the yen had a much sharper reaction and had a much significant devaluation against the US dollar and right. euro. So what do you make out of it? So does it work? So in a sense, if you only look at the yen, we see that Abe's plan has worked to a bit because he wanted a weaker yen, no?
Yeah, he wanted a weaker yen, he got a weaker yen, and he managed to maintain good relations with the main trade partners, China, United States, other Asian countries, Europe. So all in all, it's working quite well in that sense. And higher inflation, a weaker yen means somewhat higher inflation and more competitive exports. However, the growth of Japanese exports wasn't that huge. And since 2011, since the nuclear catastrophe at Fukushima, most of Japan's nuclear reactors, or almost all of them, are closed. So Japan imports much more energy. So a weaker yen makes energy imports more expensive. So that's the downside. I think that Abe intends to, I don't know if he'll be successful in, but he intends to reopen some of the nuclear reactors. We're not going to get into that controversy, but if he does succeed and everything's okay with that, it'll be a small boost for the Japanese economy.
That's it. That's our show for today. Thank you again for listening. We'll return next week with new episodes of Market Movers. So until next year, this is Lior, signing off for Yochai, saying have a great year and invest responsibly.
This podcast should be used for educational, research, and informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. There are no guarantees expressed or implied of future positive returns in regard to the subject matter contained herein. Understand the risks inherent in investing before making the decision to invest or consult an investment professional for more information. Reasonable due diligence has been performed in regards to the information in this podcast. However, the hosts and guests of this podcast expressly disclaim any liability for accidental omissions of information or errors in fact. For comments, suggestions, and questions, visit the podcast page at forexcrunch.com or tradingnrg.com, where you can also find past episodes and subscribe to the show. Our listeners make Market Movers possible.